Are we ready for the first?
Okay, we're ready.
Jolly good. My name.
Shall I introduce you?
Okay.
Why not? Why not?
This is Arthur. I've known Arthur since I was 10 years old. He's my stepfather, but since my real father died when I was 14, he's more like my real father now. And Arthur is a renowned British poet who has been writing poetry since he was very young. He actually showed me a poem that he wrote when he was 14 in this book, which I was quite amazed by. And during the time that he was married to my mother, he wasn't really writing very much poetry. But after she died 10 years ago, and he will tell you it was in an episode in Philadelphia where he was almost froze to death.
In 17 degrees Fahrenheit,
he started writing poetry again and has been writing ever since. So this is from a collection of his poetry from a boy to now, Arthur Boyas.
Well, I wasn't such a little boy at the age of 14, and there seems to be no reason why I shouldn't start at the beginning. I've been writing poetry all my life, with the exception of 40 years when I was making a living. You don't make a living writing poetry. You might make a living being a professor of poetry, and even that is pretty hard, as the universities don't pay very good salaries, not even the most eminent universities these days. I always found it very easy to write poetry, and I couldn't quite understand why, because one always heard about people working on their poems. And one day I was looking up Rilke in the Oxford Companion to German Literature when I was struck by a paragraph, and this was it. "The striking speed with which he wrote his greatest poems proves that he belonged to a small category of poets, including Goethe, with whom poems are not wrought but are incubated, often after a long period, in the unconscious mind, so that when they finally reach the surface, they can be written down, as it were, from inner dictation." That was a couple of years ago, and I realized that if I was to get a collection together, it would have to have something to do with dictation. And so I decided to call the book Dictations. And there they are. And as I had been writing for such a very long time, I said to myself, what better to put as one's first poem in any book but the poem that one regarded as one's most important poem to date. The date was actually 1940, which was a very difficult time in England because we were waiting for things to happen. It was a time in France of the phony war, but in England we were already getting bombs, and I was actually, although I was 14, I had already become part of the ARP, known as the Air Raid Precautions, and I met a friend who was in fact an Austrian refugee. He was the post rider. He had a bicycle, and we became great friends and had crazy conversations like, which was the best symphony orchestra in the world? Coming from Vienna, of course, he had said the Vienna Philharmonic. And coming from London, I, of course, very perversely said the Berlin Philharmonic. and we had rows over that. He became a very good friend and later translated the poem I'm going to read to you in English into German, which is the only part of my poetry that I know by heart. I don't know anything I've written in English, and now I'm beginning to forget the titles of things I've just written. But you will see what was going on in the mind of a 14-year-old boy in 1940. out of a meaningless beginning towards an insecure conclusion, we move the point of anchorage, and each footstep in the wrong direction is leered at by the mad anathema that poisonously fingers life and death. We march alone and quietly gather fragments made over precious by their insignificance, and try to form the lacerated pieces into their primeval unity. But of the rough-edged memories, so few are worth remembering, and those that really sway the balance seem to fit badly in the mocking pattern. Yet surely it is wrong to sit and think when living on the verge of chaos. The time is short, and threatening the finger points, but urges us beneath the febrile shadow of our nemesis to squeeze some beauty from the grudging world. That was the first poem I thought worth preserving, and it appeared in a volume of poems that was published in 1944. I was still pretty young, but by 1946 I didn't consider myself young enough to challenge Milton with a version of Lycidas, which was a pretty cheeky thing to do. But the poem actually attracted the attention of the BBC, and it was broadcast in October 1946 and read by the actress Jill Balkan, who, among other things, is the mother of the actor Daniel Day-Lewis. And I propose to read you my Lycidas, not Milton's, which is very much longer, I promise you. And I had a little tag from the original poem, "For Lycidas is dead, dead ere his prime." And then my own poem follows. "Wherever he may walk on the silent plain, there are the berries haunting him, the weeds, lacquered with water, tiding toward the cave of no return, or drifting where his blade, in vain besieged by river mirth, becomes a pattern of refraction. He notes the cold, unsmiling steeds, their gills in tumult vaunting the liquid fall, the well-worn destiny of streams and time of day. These he regards in isolation. For tumbling past the dream, they are his moon and stars, inverted catkins fallen through the oiled glass, berries that had swept his face dry of the earth and all its wish, had passed the fringe of hands far on the bank, and now were treading on the spiral of his death. The sea turned river, and he might not think that as they rode the stairs, theirs was a dead ascent, or that his breath was now become a pearl beyond inquiry, draped in a prison void of fire. And where they passed, the fallen berries was his sky, split and miraculously circled through the green gem, passaged with rain and all the water burden of his song, waking with movement the dead lips, and he the pearl wall, tender and white against the flash of his massed fortune, learning the sepulture of words where they grew from him living, and of trees also, and how each falling leaf must finally be lost." The poem attracted the attention of Alan Tate, who was at that time editor of the Sewanee Review, and I found myself published in America for the first time with this very poem. Thank you. It was not long before I realized that America was, in fact, going to be my best market, insofar as they paid me $1 a line. And $1 in 1948-49 was actually more money than I was earning from anything else. And so I sent a couple of poems to John Crow Ransom at the Kenyon Review, and he wrote back to say that these were very nice and published two of them. One of them was called Funeral. Friend, you were my child, my mother also, ages long past. The worm is dead in the shell, the spark lit its ruin. Saw my reflection stretching in crannies of earth to hoard the last part of you. In clay the earth gleams. How shall it hide its gold till you are lost out of story? Uneven the falling of rain. The yellow light unexpected dazzles the salvager in a year without myths. That poem was called Funeral, and my work continued to find favor in America. I can read you a list, if you wish, of the places it appeared. But in 1949, I was given a scholarship to Italy, and I found myself in Florence on the Garibaldi Day of 1949, and here is a poem that went into the Penguin Anthology, which sold, curiously enough, many millions of copies. We all got very badly paid for it, except for Philip Larkin, who refused to accept the fee. He said, I prefer not to be in the anthology if I'm only going to get £8, 8 shillings for my contribution. He held out, and Penguins had to give him a royalty, and as a result he got a royalty on several million copies sold. We didn't. However, Florence, Garibaldi Day, 1949. No streets, what they say. No lovers in the Via della Morina. No beauties in the Via delle Belle Donne. Only the lovely women silent on their shelves, flowers before them, fixed by the lovers of saints. And no plenty. The hands stretched out for farthings, the boys with imprisoned birds, while the amorous touch through blind chinks. The bridge and the jewels a deception, still hands grasping till the fingers reach to the clouds and pull down nightfall. Death of a day. The river fades, and the last bird moved homeward in his hungry cage. This 5th of June. No flag concerned with these. No days, as they call them. I had always been very moved by the poems of Wallace Stevens, whom I regard as the second greatest poet of the 20th century, the first being Yeats, and the third being Ezra Pound, and then, to everyone's dismay, the fourth being T.S. Eliot. I say that to everyone's dismay because so many people put Eliot at number one position. And I wrote a poem suggested by a couple of lines by Wallace Stevens, which were, I shall whisper heavenly labials in a world of gutturals. The poem is called Dazzlement by Words, and here it is. And how she whispers them demands a description. The waving of mouth, tongue flicking at its roof, and the lips etched with rivers, while her nose sips from the air its enveloping moment of breath. And in the words, there is single and double, as in all language where there is tongue to trap, as in her whole creation, when this speaks at one mouth, and her life falls to order in the first utterance. Are his ears two shells ready to turn into sea the liquid L's of her love? Do these flood like the luminous foam, drawing senses away from the darkness they crown? Yes, he is touched by her sea, and notice the change. She has whispered, and for him the world of the raised voice has vanished, and her other has mounted. For his ears now are trained on quietness that is her throat, and sifts the silence for her faintest pulses. By 1953, I was considered worthy, I suppose is the word, worthy enough to be interviewed on the BBC in my own right, not merely to be included with other people's work in programmes like New Poems and so on. And I was interviewed by a friend called John Wayne, who has some fame as a poet, as a critic, and as a novelist. Unfortunately, he is no longer with us. And I had written a poem called Profession, which was really to say what I was all about. And here I read Profession. No day to tolerate, forgetful of craft, or me, my own voice, my own words working. To be in the urge of event, the crisis of commentary through me, myself, the event. For notice, the plain, dull outfall of action needs filter, a person to pass through, blood to send echoing before deed is design, and the densening of myth leavens the language. Two such, well-ordered, dependent, and the day throws off dreams for discipline, constraint for celebration. Now, like berries, gather them, nothing without me, but in my mouth, seminal stars, and repeating ages of planets where my word has grown, accepting its history. My word from before me, compressing their life beyond me, in syllable, the all-real of experience, the hiss through my lips involving them all. Now, heart on the tree, drain your load, and fill earth below you with trembling prologue to action, so that history hesitates in the sleep of the word, and stammering wakes, is unleashed to seek its undistant event. No day without word rising high on its deep, and no voice where implicit throats have not shrilled a thousand on thousand in no day but time. That I always regarded as a kind of credo, and what was amazing about it was that it was lost for 50, maybe just a minute, 53, oh dear, more than 50 years. The poem was lost, absolutely lost, and I didn't know that I had it anywhere when I found it again, and that was a moment of great jubilation, I can tell you. I was very, very pleased about that. Now, the next poem here, which I didn't necessarily intend to read, but it's rather interesting because it matches with a poem I have just written, actually a poem I wrote as I was struggling to get out of the ultrasound room in the hospital where I was recently consigned. And I found myself writing a poem that could have been written by Emily Dickinson, and that I thought was very strange indeed. And so I went back and found the poem which I had written in 1953 called Emily Dickinson, and you will see the connection when I read the one after the other. The first one in 1953, and I'm sorry to be talking about times that are so very, very distant now, but 1953 was a good year, at least for me in poetry. And I wrote this Emily Dickinson poem, which sort of rather breathes Emily Dickinson. This frame holds all my glass. If I would strain at it and breathe on the firm water in its arms, they catch my deed. Drops fall away like flame, but from this window never. Nor has there been before in wood so fixed a river. No deed is lost, and though the glass seems to hold bright and clear, there are no sights seen once before that now same appear. Drawn into glass each move, each work its former work recolors, the separate deed had not the form my eye recovers. This sounding glass adjusts new notes to me to new notes. Outside the glass is me beyond, unhindered fates. Now the poem which I struggled to write down as I was leaving the ultrasound room, and is so Emily Dickinson, I couldn't believe I was actually writing it. Ultrasound. I heard the ocean of my blood, so strong, so loud. I never knew my chest contained so huge a crowd. With such great life in me, I thought, this could not die. It was a test, a sight to glare my inner eye. My inner ear heard all the flood, greatest resound. If I should fall in my heart's blood, I would be drowned. That's my very last poem to date, but now I'm going to do a kind of reprise back to what happened after 1953, because quite a lot happened, even if we include my 40 missing years. Yes, I had a very odd experience. I'm going to Philadelphia tomorrow, and so consequently Philadelphia has played a very important part in my life, because the new poems, which started in 2003, date from a time in December in Philadelphia, when I was actually locked out of a house in a temperature of 17 degrees. I waited, and I became very angry because I was very cold. The circumstances were quite extraordinary, but I won't go into those. And I have the person whom I would most blame for this event. I have to thank him more than words can tell, because if it had not been for the horror of the cold, in Wynwood, Pennsylvania, I would not have written my first poem in 40 years. Now, this is a very angry and desolate poem, which suited, in fact, my mood at the time I wrote it. And it starts with a line which I don't suppose I could have written if I had not been in that particular state. In the beginning is death, the cloud of unbeing, where the creature first lies, happier there, protected from the brute force which pressures his birth into a world of alarms called life, called the gift, with its promises of future delights, these in return for obedience. O great heaven, who would not call back their ship from the volatile ocean once they had learned the fate of all voyages, had suffered the entry into false ports, had tethered to false moorings, had found no safety there, nor pleasure, nor random rewards, despite much obedience. O great fabricator who weaves the child in the womb and deludes its host with such promises, what save its coarse birth into your darkness can you deliver? What has become of your long-promised light? An angry poem written by an angry man in an angry situation. And I was not to know that this was going to be the beginning of many new poems, and immediately followed by another poem, We Mark the Stations of Our Cross, their boundaries, the pain of passing them, the unknown time as yet of crucifixion. What puzzlement lies in that imprecision, not knowing when the first nail will be driven into our rebel flesh, and by whose hand the blow will fall, as fall it must, when we have finally arrived at consciousness after a lifetime's dull meandering. And now, drink after long thirst, waking after long sleep. The devil surely had his way with me. Now, speech after long silence. Winged words, shafted with terrible song. Poem I know Paul wanted to hear the other night, which I think he likes. He called it The Swan, and this was again a poem written by the element of chance, insofar as I'd gone to a place I shouldn't have gone to, on a day I shouldn't have gone to that place, and I saw a swan, a black swan, in the river that is beside it. And if I hadn't gone to meet the person on the wrong day and in the wrong place, I would not have written this poem. So there is an element of chance in all of this. A constant of this life, a lean black swan with ruby beak, his leanness manifest, cleaving the lake almost disdainfully. When will he lift that ruby clarion and tell my time has come? But now it is below his notice, and cleaving, gliding, he turns out of view. I became very much a person who would look at paintings and would write poems about them. And this all started in Philadelphia in the Museum of Art at the Manet and the Sea exhibition, in 2004, and I wrote a poem on Whistler's Variations in Violet and Green. A perfect purity. A man stands on the shore, the figure hazed by mist, or is it water? Solid and yet transparent. Could colour ever be so light that form and background make a depthless unity? The man, who is he? That oh-so-valid daytime ghost. The shore forever painted by his pale dissolve into the rain, the sand, the sky. I plagiarize my dreams, in which I open books where all is written. The books with beveled edges contain it all. They are my source, or am I theirs? The words tell of experience. These things have been, and in my life, but when? Still, they are down in print, and all I need to do is copy them and read my life as it arises from the page to tell me where I lived and what I was, the stranger and familiar with a pen. We are our culture. Who will understand us in that arid future? Perhaps some sour old men scanning for footnotes to a vanished age, erased by progress and the myriad keys on wonderful machines that throttled thought and left them stranded with a memory, however faint, of something going wrong, of something lost, of everything, in fact, that separated us from that new present where the words are dead without a page to lie on. And all the brave ideas, those same which ferried bloodshed into foreign parts, already bloodied by culture of their own, which other soured old men had delved for footnotes of their vanished age, the paradise of earlier times, before those wonderful machines had made it all so easy to go wrong. Yeah. By July 2004, I was a confirmed Luddite. I wanted to see pretty well all the new machines destroyed, and I would have led the assault. Yes, there we are. I had a friend at my early school who had a father who by 1938 was still scratching himself and pulling out pieces of shrapnel which were coming through his lymphatics from the First World War. That was 1938. I was very surprised. I have a friend in Germany whose uncle died in 1926 when a piece of shrapnel actually got into a chamber of his heart and killed him. And that, in fact, really got me going on this poem. Like shrapnel in a leg for 80 years, working for release through tortuous lymphatics. An irritation first, and then a prickling, as its sharp spine breaks the skin's lid, and hardly bleeding begs to be dislodged. A careful fingernail can manage this, and there it is, hardly a tin tack, a heart of long-forgotten hatred in a place as long-forgotten, except as illustration of a war published in parts on art paper for final detail, marking the splodges of each shell as it went crashing into healthy bodies, spewing its metal, cutting some in half. Unlucky were they, or luckier, perhaps, than those who lost a face and arms, their sight and hearing, and then reduced, returned, and waited for the armistice. But here my crumb of shrapnel is resurrected after long burial in human flesh, emerging like a poem to the light.
Dictation?
Oh, it's all a dictation. Everything here is dictation. Absolutely all of it. And you never know when it's going to be dictated. On New Year's Eve, for example, December 31st, 2004, I found myself in Miami, and everybody was having a thoroughly good time, as one does have. It was a wonderful place. I mean, dancing, music, drink, everything you could have had. But I, unfortunately, was being dictated to. And when you're dictated to, you can't say, go away, I'm doing something else. You actually do exactly what you're told.
Pardon? Who is dictating?
Ah, that all comes later. You'll get it all. Yes. And so I wrote literally in the club in Miami on the wonderful day of December the 31st. Don't forget, there had just been the, what was it? You see, I forget words.
Tsunami.
The tsunami. And there was, of course, everything else happening, awful things in the world, and I had to write on my menu, in fact, in all this blaze, the terrible year ends. The vanquished, thinking themselves victors. Yes, that was another thing. We had won the war in Iraq, you remember? So the vanquished believed themselves to be victors. The earth exploding in shame. The seas rebelling. And that was the tsunami. At nature's command, engulfing the innocent. Where was their complicity in all this horror? The sin of being there was quite enough. It ended them and all their futures. Blank spaces in the great book of tomorrow. That was the way I celebrated New Year's Eve 5 years ago. I was then in correspondence with a very good poet whom I had known since 1943. And he was having a very hard time. He had published 40 books. None of them was being requested by the library people. Nobody was going to the libraries and asking, because we have a lending right by which people whose books are requested and go out, are stamped by the libraries, get a very, very small sum of money, a pittance, in fact. But it proves to them that they are somehow current, they're still in the world, you know. And I was very depressed when he told me that nobody in the last year had asked to see one of his books, and that was terrible. And then I was actually in Miami, and in the middle of the night, I found a piece of paper, switched the light on, and wrote a poem. I hadn't actually written a poem for 3 months because I was so depressed by what Michael had told me. Michael was the poet I'm talking about, whose books hadn't gone out in the library. And I wrote a poem by dictation, of course, like virtually all the stuff I'm reading tonight. I am confronted by this page, its words unchangeable as scripture, as deep as gorges, as high as mighty wings surmounting them. What does it mean that I am raised on high and offered all this earth if I forswear my will, become an instrument, a vessel of the power that orders words because it has invented them, and sees a chance to reinvent them, using this casual tube, myself, to sheath its word-filled phallus, and so bring to birth what could not be by reason, but only by its consummate intent. And that was the beginning of a new period, actually, in my life, but continuing with poems on pictures, which influenced me greatly. And I went to the Turks exhibition at the Royal Academy in March 2005 and saw something that moved me greatly. And it was, oddly enough, a Quran. And I wrote this poem there and then. Or I was dictated this poem there and then is more correct. Pale on dark gold, a seemly luxury, calligraphy for angels. The divine Quran asks nothing less. Each word a revelation for the true believer. For the illiterate, a wonder that this flowing alphabet, which streams through all the intervening years, presents a symmetry transcending images taken from nature. These are just words in honor of their text, where artistry within its measured millimetric rule turns words to gold, and doing so transforms the perfect craftsman into God. A poem on a film. I don't know if you saw the film, what was it called, Downfall, about the last days of Hitler in his bunker. Did you? No, nobody saw it? You saw it. Good, excellent. Fine. The history is in the horror. No Holocaust ruffles the conversation of these polite comedians in their Elysian fields set underground, away from bombs, away from the exterior and other human interferences. Here cooking proceeds. The intervals merge into one. The bit players eat proper food. The Führer has his special egg and mashed potatoes. When not at table, he scans the maps with useless eyes, moves non-existent armies, plans further counterattacks. They've let him down, those well-born officers, a rotten class. Their day is past. And that unworthy German people, whose blood was simply not enough to shed for his world order. What cowards, what betrayal, when victory was just around the corner. To hell with them. The youth is still our hope. Ours? Where are the others? Eating, drinking, laughing, as the last day dawns. The bullet waiting in the careful gun. Also the capsule. Their final solution. When horror is their only history. Coming back by air one day, I had a strange idea. What an odd thing the body was. What on earth was it all about? And so I wrote a poem. Again, by dictation. The odd contraption of the body. Eyes before brain. That's logical. the nose to smell what the mouth eats or says. Behind the teeth, the tongue, raised or depressed, to make our words. Where do these come from? I say that they were always here, an endless roll, starting from everlasting, and we just parrot them. And the body too, a replica of that first body when it all began in the eye of God, when he had tired of galaxies and thought of beings to whom he could teach thought and language, perhaps even converse eventually, explaining his deep plans, trying them out on a frail race below the angels. That was his big wish. Now see how it has all turned out. When I, the lowest of his low, dissect his purpose, anatomize the poor result, starting with the body and ending with myself. How are you doing with patience, I must ask? How are you doing with patience? I still have plenty here.
Does anybody want to have a break and get some more to eat and drink?
You might like to do that.
Intermission.
Pardon? Thank you. I need that. I'm getting a little dry.